Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Home turf trouble with Islam was supposed to be Europe's problem. America had 9/11, but while Europe wrestled with culture clash, America and its many Muslim citizens were largely calm, cool, at home together. Then came New York's controversial Islamic Center, the Quran burning threat, Fort Hood, and fiery headlines. Big Islamic thinker Tariq Ramadan says it can and should all be good. But he's got his critics, too. This hour, On Point, Tariq Ramadan on Islam and the West. And we'll check in on the rescue of the Chilean miners. You can join the conversation. Have you followed Tariq Ramadan? Is he right? Is he true? Can we all get along? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now in the studio is Tariq Ramadan. He's professor of contemporary Islamic studies at Oxford University, president of the think tank European Muslim Network in Brussels. He was banned from entering the United States for 6 years, starting in the Bush administration. He's author of much scholarship and many sermons heard throughout the Islamic world. He was born Egyptian, but is barred from visiting Egypt. His newest books are What I Believe and The Quest for Meaning, Developing a Philosophy of Pluralism. Tariq Ramadan, welcome back to On Point.
Thank you so much. Thank you for your invitation.
What kind of reception are you getting in the United States now that Hillary Clinton has restored your visa and you're here?
So far, it's very, very interesting and very, very good. You know, I came 4 or 5 times now in the States since the ban was lifted, and what I got in New York, throughout the country, because I visited so many cities over the last 10 days, for example, is really reactions and feedbacks that are quite interesting. Of course, there is a great deal of fear and mistrust and questions. Over the last few months, we have felt that in the country. Mm-hmm. So there are questions, but at the same time, there is what I really expected from the beginning, a great deal of goodwill from American citizens to try to go beyond this perceived clash of, you know, within the society between Muslims and non-Muslims, and all this business of this fear of Islamization of America, which is really worrying when we listen to such statements today in the States.
We want to talk about that in depth, and we will. Take us back for a moment to people who haven't followed your story. 2004, you were supposed to go to Notre Dame in Indiana. You were basically, your family, you were all on the way, ready to go, and suddenly no visa. The Bush administration pointed to to contributions you had made to Islamic charities linked to Hamas, and your visa was revoked.
Yes, in fact, it was not exactly this at the beginning. For 2 years, we were asking, why have you revoked my visa after it was given and all my furniture was already in South Bend? And then we had no answer till, you know, 2 years later. And then they sent someone when they asked me to reapply to the American Embassy in Switzerland. And they were asking me to which organizations I was giving money. I myself told them. And then they used this by saying, look, you gave money to organizations that are linked to or supposedly or allegedly connected to Hamas. But they made a mistake, is that I gave the money between 1998 and 2002. And this organization was blacklisted in the States in 2003. Mm-hmm. And they sent me a letter saying, you should reasonably have known. And I responded, I should reasonably have known before yourself that this organization would be blacklisted. Mm-hmm. So it was a kind of a silly argument. And then it was all about politics and my criticisms towards the Bush administration and the policies in Iraq and the policies in Palestine. And then this is why just last year we had the new administration and Hillary Clinton just removing and saying there is no justification for him not to be able to enter the country.
Let's get right into what's hot now. We want your big thesis, but we might as well get it in context. We just came through a period like few Americans can remember. Maybe none. I can't remember any other period of this kind of tension and high rhetoric that we saw about Muslims in America, as we saw around the Islamic Center in Lower Manhattan, near Ground Zero, so-called, and this threatened Quran burning by a teeny tiny church in Florida, but got the whole world on edge. And the rhetoric got very, very high. Here was, on August 16th, former Republican House Speaker Newt Gingrich likening supporters of the Islamic Cultural Center at Ground Zero to Nazis. Here he is on Fox News Network's Fox and Friends.
Nazis don't have the right to put up a sign next to the Holocaust Museum in Washington. We would never accept the Japanese putting up a site next to Pearl Harbor. Right. There's no reason for us to accept a mosque next to the World Trade Center.
Tariq Ramadan is with us. Tariq, Professor Ramadan, you've been writing to American Muslims in very, very publicly, trust America. This is going to be all right. But here's pretty harsh criticism where, you know, the placement of a cultural center in a sensitive zone, and you're saying yourself it shouldn't be there, but gets this comparison to Nazis.
Yes, I think it's unacceptable, first, because, you know, there is a consensus and quite clearly a condemnation coming from all the Muslim scholars and the Muslims around the world by saying what happened in the States in September 11th was against the Islamic teachings and against us, against Muslims. It's not Islam. So now to come by saying, you know, we connect this to Islam is first wrong. The second is the comparison with Nazi and saying that this is representing the Muslims. While the community center, the most important objective is to do exactly the opposite, is just to open up to the surrounding society. So this is one thing which is not acceptable. And then there is something which is called freedom of religion in this country, and this is the very essence of this country, that this is the rights of the Muslims and the Muslim citizens. So I would say I wouldn't accept such, you know, statements, because these kind of statements are not only dangerous for Muslims, they are dangerous for the future of America. It's the future of the very essence of this country. So this is why we have to resist these kind of statements by saying this is not acceptable. At the same time, the Muslims today in the United States, and you know, I was not expecting that. For years I have been saying that, the populist trends that we have in Europe, mm-hmm. that are very powerful in the Netherlands, in Switzerland, in France.
Very worried about Islamization,
exactly.
Worried about headscarves and head-to-toe and minarets and all that. Yes.
Exactly. I thought it was a very European phenomenon. Mm-hmm. And then here we are in the States having exactly the same rhetoric and people going as far as what we just heard, which is just unbelievable, that it's new for me. And I think that it's quite shocking for many American citizens to listen to such a rhetoric. But it means that deep down, behind the scene, the feeling of mistrust and fear among American citizens is there. You cannot just deny the fact that there is fear in this country. So 10 years after September 11th, the Muslim citizens, the Muslim American citizens, mm-hmm. should listen to these voices and say, we are not going to retreat, we are not going to apologize, but we need to get a better sense of the collective psychology in this country by being more vocal on our Islamic teachings, our values, our presence in this country, our contribution to the United States of America. And I would say that over the last 10 years, we have seen many Muslim organizations reaching out and speaking out. They have to do more, but also to call their fellow citizens to be
to
with
cool
them
down. To you're saying
no. To call them.
Call.
Call. Mm-hmm. Yes, this mm-hmm. is the French.
Mm-hmm. Good. Fine.
To call them to come with them and to be able also to resist all these trends that could push towards discrimination. There are not less than 30 mosques in this country mm-hmm. that are prevented from being built, and I think that this is wrong. So we should not give act on the rights that the Muslims have to build mosques and to be respected in this country. And at the same time, to take into account the symbolic dimension of, you know, Park 51. This is what I was mentioning
Lower
in my
Manhattan,
text.
Yeah.
And saying, look, in this, you have to enter into a dialogue and to take into account the feeling without giving up your rights.
But you're saying, still, if you take into account feelings, don't put it there.
Yes, I think that it's really, for me, it's not only a question of rights. It's to get a comprehensive understanding of what is happening in the country. So I would say I'm not going to be obsessed with this. I would say let us work together on the 30 mosques that are prevented from being built in this country. And on this, why not being more creative? We got some proposals coming from Muslims. We may make it an Abrahamic center, make it something which is open, inclusive. Mm-hmm. Why not? Muslims should take the lead of this kind of constructive dialogue.
But listen to this. This was Imam Faisal Abdul Rauf, the leader of the project to build the Islamic center near Ground Zero. This is talking with ABC's Christian Amanpour just last month. And he said, and everybody's heard this, that moving the center might fuel Islamist radicals.
My major concern with moving it is that the headline in the Muslim world will be Islam is under attack in America. This will strengthen the radicals in the Muslim world, help their recruitment. This will put our people, our soldiers, our troops, our embassies, our citizens under attack in the Muslim world. And we have expanded and given and fueled terrorism.
There's Imam Faisal Abdul Rauf, the leader, who said he wants to put it there as a symbol of how religions can get along. Tariq Ramadan is with me. Do you think, if it's moved now, no sign of that at the moment as far as I know, but if it should be, will it fuel terrorism?
No, I think I heard this argument and I heard him saying this. I think it's not what could happen, and I don't think that anything could happen which is terrorist attack because we moved it. I think that whatever is the situation is an American business. It has to be solved by American citizens, and to be quite clear on what we are saying. It's not to move it because we are scared or we are compromising. Mm-hmm. We are thinking about a solution where the American citizens could understand that Islam is not a problem in this country, and that the American Muslim citizens understand the collective psychology while they want their rights to be respected, and they have a comprehensive approach of the whole thing. Mm-hmm. So I would argue that what we got over the last few months is this crisis, but also the mayor of New York, Jewish intellectuals and leaders, Christian leaders, and agnostics, atheists, coming and saying, this is not right, this is not America. Let us build on that, on this kind of citizenship, and not just against, nurture the fear of the American citizens, putting them under pressure. If you don't go that way, you will have radicals reacting. I think it's not the right answer.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with Islamic thinker, leader, lightning rod, Tariq Ramadan, about Islam, the West, and his call for a philosophy of pluralism. He joins me in the studio. Could not have done that for about 6 years. His visa was revoked in the Bush administration. Did not end up being able to go to Notre Dame. He's now at Oxford University, Egyptian-born, lived nearly all of his life in Europe. Two books out, What I Believe and The Quest for Meaning, Developing a Philosophy of Pluralism. He attracts a lot of attention and discussion wherever he goes. Let's go to April in Beverly, Massachusetts. You're on the air with Tariq Ramadan. Hi, April.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Tariq. I just want to make a point. I use this as sort of a silly argument, maybe, but I think the Islamic Center should certainly go up. We have freedom of religion in this country. And I use the argument, you know, if we're going to think along those terms, then probably any Christian Protestant site that has been built anywhere near any American Indian sacred grounds should be taken down. Or we should never build one again near any, you know, American Indian sacred grounds if we're going to run along those ideas.
Right, so take it away there. Have you talked with Imam Rauf, Tariq Ramadan?
I know him. I haven't talked about this very specific issue because we met just before in Singapore, and I have seen how he positioned himself on that. Once again, I think that on the rights field, and as we are talking now, there is no point to remove it because, once again, this is the right of the Muslims and this is freedom of religion. But we are in a society and we are in time where, without giving up our rights, we also have to take into account something which has to do with the collective sensitivity and the collective psychology. So to balance the approach, mm-hmm. by having a comprehensive approach, by saying we might understand the symbolic dimension here and we might do something which is a bit different or remove it or think of something which is more creative, as I was told many times, we can go for that. Now, this is where I am asking the fellow American citizens, don't just talk in an easy way about the rights of the Muslims when it comes to Park 51. Mm-hmm. Be able to talk about their rights everywhere in this country, where we all know that they are facing discriminations when it comes to very small mosques and mm-hmm. projects. Mm-hmm. And no one is talking about this. Mm-hmm. So don't use the symbol to forget the reality.
That reality, a lot of American Muslims are facing it. But you had this big piece within the last month in the Washington Post, very prominently. Headline, "Even Now, Muslims Must Have Faith in America." And you concluded it saying this, and it's interesting, when you heard Newt Gingrich there making this kind of Nazi comparison, nevertheless, you wrote, "Whatever controversies may rage in New York, Florida, elsewhere," and you're writing to American Muslims here, you said, "we should trust the enduring positive forces at work in American society." Why do you make that argument to this population, the American Muslim?
Because I think that under pressure, in this atmosphere, it's very easy to start playing the victim mentality and to feel we are not like in this country. While, if you look, for example, and I'm referring to this in the piece, about the African-American struggle, which mm-hmm. it's not because, you know, the President Barack Obama now is the president that the struggle is over. It's an ongoing struggle. But over the last two centuries, we have seen the African-American being now part of the society, in the mainstream, and they have hope in this society. And I think that this is what the Muslims should understand, that whatever are the controversies, they are temporary controversies, but in the end, the future is for the normalization of Islam as an American religion, because today Islam is an American religion, and the Americans and the Muslim Americans are American and they are citizens. So they have to look at what is happening and to take advantage of all is happening beyond the controversies to see that they have fellow citizens, Americans. They are ready now to work with them, to struggle for their rights. You know, I have been protected myself with so many organizations, not Muslims, mm-hmm. and coming to say, this is not America. It cannot be accepted because we are acting against our very principles. I think that this is where we have to put our hope, and this is where we can work together.
Maybe this takes us to what might be the deepest question here, the question that perhaps leaves unease in some people's minds. I mean, America had a strong religious background and strong views of faith in history and today. Nevertheless, it's built on a secular Constitution, ideas that came out of the Enlightenment in Europe. There's been tension between fundamentalist Christians and yes. those values. Mm-hmm. But there are still questions, and you hear them all the time in Europe. You must hear them in this country about whether, all right, you know, our Muslim population is not small anymore. 30 mosques, more mosques yes. want to be built. If we look down the road, does this religion, Islam, and the core foundation of American values, which are based on a secular constitution, can it coexist with a religion that says the Quran is the final word and all law is there, period?
No, this is not what the Muslims are saying. They believe in that the Quran is the final word, but they also believe that out of the principles that you find in the Quran, you have a rational take in building, shaping, you know, the laws and the legislations of the country. It's not something which is a black and white approach. And when the people are having this, you know, it's coming from Orientalists. Very often they think that, oh, Islam cannot live in a secular space. My first book that I wrote in the beginning of the 90s mm-hmm. was Muslims in Secular Societies, mm-hmm. showing that beyond our perceptions, beyond these statements that you just made, you have millions of European Muslims, American Muslims, Canadian Muslims, or Syrian Muslims living in the society. They abide by the law of the country. They are loyal to the country. They speak the language of the country, the three L's that I'm mentioning mm-hmm. in the book, what I believe, mm-hmm. law, loyalty, and language.
Law, loyalty,
yes,
language.
Exactly.
Okay.
So the three L's, and they are. So let us speak about figures and facts. And we can see now that they don't have a problem with the secular society. They should be treated as equal citizens. So as a Muslim, I was born and raised in Europe. Mm-hmm. I don't have a problem with the law. It's exactly the opposite what is happening. And this is what I was saying to the French government. You were saying that the Muslims wanted to change the law. Mm-hmm. We are asking you to abide by the very value and principles of the French legislations by treating the Muslims the same way. We ended up in 2004 having the French government changing the law to ban the headscarf in schools. Mm-hmm. They changed the law to make mm-hmm. it more restrictive. The Muslims don't have a problem. So
why do you think they did that? Is that pure ethnic prejudice, or is that fear that somehow, you know, through this growing cultural presence in Europe, the core values that undergird French law are threatened?
I think it's out of fear. It's out of political game as well, because, you know, the law are not the only solution. When you trust your fellow citizens, you look at the law as an inclusive reality. We want to integrate the people within the law. When you are scared of your citizens and the people who are here, you use the law to protect yourself. So it's out of fear. That's for sure. And this is why I'm saying laws are not the only answer. We need to work on perceptions and understandings and psychology and feeling good, feeling at home.
You blamed Orientalists for raising this question, but a lot of people, I mean, look at realities. They look at the Islamic world, don't see a whole lot of very strong secular government there. A lot of religious back government, and certainly not only Orientalists who are saying that there's a conflict between Western ways and Islam.
No, you are right. You are right. And I think that many Muslim scholars, I also always saying this also in my books, is that many Muslims having a very simplified and simplistic way of dealing with this. But the point for me is really to look at the Muslim majority countries. What is lacking in the Arab Muslim majority countries is really democracy, but it has nothing to do with religion, because you have, you know, a state like Saudi Arabia, which is a very religious state. It's a religious state. But in the country where I'm coming from, in Egypt, it's not a religious country. It's a secular government, and the secular government is not a democratic government. So whatever is the model that we have, what is lacking today in the Muslim majority country is freedom and democracy and democratization, and it has nothing to do with religion. So to reduce this to Islam is problematic, because what about then Turkey, which is a Muslim majority country with a democratic process, Indonesia, more democratic process, Senegal, more democratic process. So we should not reduce Islam to some Arab countries that are facing the dictatorship.
If the Muslim Brotherhood took over in Egypt, do you believe they would institute a secular democratic society?
This is what they are. This is not what they are calling, and they are no. But the point is that whatever are the trends within the Muslim majority country, you have today Islamists, and some of the Islamists are talking about not confusing or joining politics and religions, and some are saying we are distinguishing authorities. Look at, for example, the example of Turkey. These people who are in now running the country, they were Islamists in the past, and they are now moving towards something which is acknowledging and challenging the army by asking for more democratic processes. So I think that...
But aren't they simultaneously moving Turkey away from much of its secular tradition, or talking about that?
It depends on which kind of secularism, because there are not only one type of secular society. Mm-hmm. If you have behind the secular society the army that is not letting the people being free, I think that we have to challenge. Secularity is not only distinguishing religion from the state, or the church from the state. It's also for us to promote the democratic process. What is happening in Muslim majority countries is that we are separating the church from the state, or the Muslim or the religion from politics, but without democracy. So it's secular model minus democratic processes. And I think that this is problematic. For us today in the West, I would say that most people around us should look at how the Muslims are now being citizens in their Western countries. Mm-hmm. And they are promoting democracy. They want to be citizens, and they abide by the law. So let us come to the facts and not being misled by perceptions.
Tariq Ramadan is with us. His new book is The Quest for Meaning, Developing a Philosophy of Pluralism. He was banned from visiting this country. Now he's back. Let's get our callers in here. Cambridge, Massachusetts, Shalom is on the air. Shalom, you're on with Tariq Ramadan. Hello, Shalom, are you there? Seems like we lost him. Let's get another. Lansing, Michigan, Dave, you're on the air with Tariq Ramadan. Dave.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. First, I'd like to say that it's just so scary for me, you know, reading the headlines and watching the TV every day. About how, this country seems to be turning into some, all religions but this one type of freedom. And it just scares the daylights out of me. I just cannot, for the life of me, understand why Americans want to turn this country into some sort of, like, totalitarian dictatorship. And a lot of the folks that you see in the headlines or whatever, you know, are putting up fences on whatever to keep whomever out, and, you know, arming everything, you know.
Dave, what's your experience with Muslim? Do you have experience with Muslim Americans, Dave?
I do. I worked with them in the. I was a dental technician for a while. I was laid off a few years ago, and you know, I've served with them in the military. You know, I go to the mosques and I go to the synagogues and I go to the churches in Lansing. You know, just to you know, see what's up. And you know, all I see are you know, loving people who do not deserve the attacks that they're getting in our media. I see, you know, the whole thing about the mosque in New York, you know, is just you know, it's saying, you know, we're no longer Americans. We've become something else.
Dave, we got it, and I appreciate your call very much. Thank you very much for being there listening in Lansing. Let's get one more. Cross Plains, Tennessee. Joshua, you're on the air with Tariq Ramadan.
Hi. How are you doing?
Pretty well. What do you think, Josh? What do you know?
I have a question. I was wondering what you thought about American understanding of Muslims. I think the only real understanding that we have is basically only seeing them through the eyes of us seeing them as terrorists and seeing them as hateful people, not seeing them as loving, caring, real people. They're all masked, unfortunately, through 9/11, such as events as that and other terrorist events that have happened, not as actual people.
Tariq, how do you respond?
Yes, we had two important contributions here. Is the first one that I just want to say something about that, because it's really our responsibility. Someone saying, you know, it seems that America is changing. Of course, America is changing with the new visibility of Muslims, and this is the real meaning of a pluralistic society. And he's saying, in order to get a better sense of what is happening, I go to the synagogue, I go to the mosque, I go to meet the people. And I think that if there is something where we should be serious about it, we cannot just sit down and say, I'm an open-minded citizen, I'm open to everything, and not do the job of connecting to people,
but
reaching out.
But not everybody's going to do that. You know human nature. But nobody can miss the terror attacks of 9/11, the attacks now from even American Muslims within this country, the continued rhetoric of Islamists against democracy, against the secular state.
You are saying not everyone is going to do that. But if we are serious about the future of a pluralistic society, we should call our citizens to do that. You know, I'm just coming from in the heartland of this country, in Oklahoma, and I met with citizens. And I can tell you that there is a great deal of goodwill. And this is what I call the new we, which is necessary.
The new we.
Yes.
Meaning?
It's you and me struggling together in the name of what are the our common values. What was said right now by your guest, which is the American values, that we need to come to something which is this. So we need national movements of local initiatives where we come together as citizens and we work. This is what we need. Now, the second thing which is important is that very often with all these national controversies, it's as if we are forgetting the very essence of Islam and perceiving Muslims as, you know, just problems and dangers and people who are threatening the very essence of America. We don't come to what Islam is all about. You know, 90% of the talks that I'm giving to some, you know, open audiences is about what Islam is not. Let me talk about what Islam is as giving me answer to my life. It's a meaning of life. It's a spirituality. There are values that are common to Christianity, to Judaism, to Buddhism, to Hinduism, to philosophical ideals and atheistic ideals as well. So I would say that this is where we have to come to open up our dialogue and our way of communicating, not only on problems, but also on our daily life. And this is why I'm saying to the Muslims, the American Muslims, don't only come with others and open up when you have problems in times of crisis, like, for example, after New York. But when you are dealing with the society, you should be involved in education. You should be involved in arts. You should be involved in movies. You should be involved in environment. We need the American Muslims to be everywhere. And this is what I call normalizing our presence without trivializing it, meaning by this, show that you are contributing. Don't come with a sense that, oh, I am a minority. You know, I'm against these two features of the wrong mentality, victim mentality and minority feeling. Get rid of that and be part of the society.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with Islamic thinker, leader, lightning rod, Tariq Ramadan. about Islam, the West, and his call for a philosophy of pluralism. We're going to check in a few minutes on the situation of the miners coming up out of that collapsed mine in Chile. But Tariq Ramadan is with us right now in the studio. Could not do that for years. Was banned from visiting the U.S. And during the George W. Bush administration, Hillary Clinton has lifted that ban. He's here. He's talking. Let's go to Worcester, Massachusetts, and Saeed. Saeed, you're on the air with Tariq. Saeed, are you there?
Yes, I'm here. Hello, Tom. Hi, Tariq. And thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to comment on basically what Mr. Tariq Ramadan is saying, which I agree a lot with. I'm basically a Muslim, but not practicing. But a lot of times I find myself having to defend the community. So we need somebody like him who basically explains the religions as it should. A lot of times I see him debating people like Ayan Hirsi Ali, for instance, or Eric Zemmour. Zemmour, I believe. And they always accuse him of double discours, which he usually does a very, very, very good job. And I have to congratulate him on saying the right things. And a lot of times you find these people not having any answers to tell them. They're always accusing the Muslim community of this, of that. But then when it comes to facts, they just lack of proofs, and it always becomes just some sort of accusation, basically just talk. And also, I just wanted to say the difference between Muslims in America and Muslims in Europe, which I've been in Europe, and I'm an American citizen here. I can tell you that in Europe right now, they're just waking up to reality that they can't deal with. For instance, in France, they have these neighborhoods, these ghettos, and just they don't know what to do with these millions of youth, thousands,
yeah,
perhaps criminals and all that, and they relate that to religion, and all of a sudden to find some scapegoat, they always try to basically stick it to burqa or some of these basically, frankly, women choice. Even though I do not agree per se on women should cover their face, I personally don't think they should. But however, if they choose to do so, I just don't understand why France or Nicolas Sarkozy is going to pass a law banning basically just a few, literally few, from what I heard, hundreds of women, not even to pass a law.
Saeed, we've got it, and we hear your passion on it, and I thank you for your call. Thank you very much. Tariq Ramadan, I don't know, let's go to France and let's go to Europe for a second. And because a lot of Americans look and they say, all right, we've had pretty good relations, by and large, until recently in this country with our American Muslim population. Quite good. Now you look at Europe where they have a higher percentage of Muslims and we see all kinds of tension and struggle and pushback against head covering, murders of those who have been critical of the Islamic community, and people say, oh my gosh, is that what lies down the road for the United States? Hmm. Is Europe just 20 years ahead of us? Is that where we're headed to?
No, I think it's very important not to compare and to take it as a similar situation. I think that in Europe we have specific situations, and more importantly, even between Britain or France or Italy or mm-hmm. Spain, these are not the same realities. And instead of comparing the realities, we should look at what is happening within every single society, between the values that are proclaimed in the society and the practices. This is what is now a problem. And once again, what we have today in Europe is lack of social policies, lack of a vision for the future, and we end up culturalizing, religionizing, Islamizing the problems. In the suburbs in France, it's not a religious problem, but we end up making it a religious problem while it's a problem of equalities, discrimination, and social justice. And I would say we have to be very cautious in the United States of America. Even though it's not the same, the immigrants that came in this country are not poor people. They are very well educated. Still, look at what is happening with African American within mm-hmm. in the inner cities, and don't come with something which is culturalizing the problem. Look at some voices that we heard recently. People, they don't say about the President Barack Obama that he's an African American. They said he's an Arab, a crypto Muslim.
Mm-hmm.
putting Islam outside the realm of America. Mm-hmm. They want to culturalize the problem and not to speak about the fact that Islam is an American religion. And then the Muslims should be very cautious not to import some of the rhetoric that we had in Europe.
Saeed's clearly a big supporter of yours, but he also raises this issue, which critics have raised. They said, you know, they say, Tariq Ramadan, you're beautifully well-spoken. You really are good on this theme of normalization and the new we. But he talked there about the double discourse. Hmm. And people say, you know, you're kind of sweet-talking us here, but this can't actually happen. You had a debate just in the last week in New York with Christopher Hitchens. Yes. Now, you know, you're Muslim. He's famously atheist, talking about whether or not Islam is a religion of peace. He brought up the 1989 fatwa against Salman Rushdie, calling for his death for insulting Islam in the novel The Satanic Verses. And he accused, well, here just a little bit of this, he accused Islamists of doublespeak, some defenders like yourself, I should say, of doublespeak, officially standing down on that fatwa. But, you know, some kind of keeping that death threat alive. Not you, but others in prayer meetings. Here's a bit of Hitchens in that meeting.
Some people say that Islam and Islamists give themselves permission to lie to non-believers. Sounds like the sort of vulgar, paranoid thing that an Islamophobe would go around saying, doesn't it? It's very easy to disprove, except that it hasn't been. And these are not minor threats. These are threats to the very core of what we believe is the essential thing for a society, which is the ability to ask questions, to read the books we choose, to pursue unfettered investigations. And these are flatly negated by the claims of a religion that says it is the answer to everything.
A religion that says it's the answer to everything. And then Sayed raises Ayaan Hirsi Ali, of course, the Muslim-born Somali, now in the U.S., who's, you know, famously going around now telling Americans that the West tradition of intellectual revolt against clerical tyranny is under threat, and it's under threat by mounting Islamic influence. What do you say to these kind of voices?
Yes, first, you know, Ayaan Hirsi Ali, she's presenting herself as an ex-Muslim, and she's saying, because I was a Muslim, I am more, competent to speak about this because I know it from within. But the point is
she's not a fool.
No, the point is that she is essentializing some of the voices, saying Islam is this, while not taking into account the long tradition, the wide tradition of Islam, and the different voices. And if you don't agree with them, say, oh, double talk, because Islam is not saying this, by quoting some, you know, radical views. And I think that, more importantly, I don't have a problem with the fact that she's an ex-Muslim. I have a problem with her political views that are very close to racist rejection by Islamizing everything and by saying this Islam, which is a problem. And this is where she's coming from with the neocon in this country. So this is where she is. Now, in this discussion about Hitchens, you are just quoting what he said, but I responded to this by saying, once again, look, on the double talk, it's the easiest way to make your voice not heard by saying, oh, we don't trust you because you say something, but you mean something else. Mm-hmm. And for the last 25 years, I have been repeating what I'm telling you now. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if I had a double talk, why am I banned from Saudi Arabia, Egypt, Tunisia, where they are not democracy and they don't like what I'm saying? So we need to have something which is starting with trust to check our arguments and to come to a critical discussion. And this is where, for example, with Hitchens, by saying, oh, the Muslims, they believe that the Quran is saying everything, so it means that is going from a total answer to totalitarianism because this is part of it. I say, what is this? What kind of argument is this? Because Islam is a comprehensive religion and the Quran is, yes, the very word of God for Muslims. But the problem is not in the text. The problem is in the reader, because we have Muslims like me that are contextualizing the text, understanding that some verses should be historically contextualized, and they come with something which is has nothing to do with a totalitarian attitude.
So you're great. Grandfather famously was a founder of the Muslim Brotherhood. What do you think, and your father was very much involved, you can't go back to Egypt even now. Mm. What do you think your grandfather would think of the message that you're bringing about this new we? Would he agree with that?
But he was in his context.
When it comes
in the 40s.
To Israel, Americans?
No, I think that once again, we should not simplify his positions on many things in the 40s.
I'm just asking you.
No, but you are asking me as usual. I'm asking about my grandfather when there is nothing to say about me. But when I'm asking about him, I think that we have to understand him in his context. He was resisting Western colonization and he had a perception of the West from Egypt. I'm a Westerner.
I live from within, and I would say that this is where I'm consistent with my values. I'm fully Muslim, fully European, fully Western, and what I'm advocating is that we can be both at the same time, but we all have to make an effort for Muslims to make ourselves better understood and for our fellow citizens to listen and to trust more by being by reaching out and trusting your fellow citizens. If we are not going to build the future of pluralistic society on trust, it's going to be mistrust, fear, suspicion, and at the end, rejection. But there is room for maneuver to build a society where pluralism means something for all of us.
Tariq Ramadan, his new book is The Quest for Meaning, Developing a Philosophy of Pluralism. Tariq Ramadan, thanks very much for being here.
Thank you.
In a moment, we'll turn to the dramatic rescue of the Chilean miners. This is On Point. After 69 days, the 33 miners trapped away underground in a Chilean copper mine are one by one stepping into the sunlight and the spotlight. It has been a major national, international rescue effort and an amazing ordeal. We go right now to Seth Doan. He's joining us from the San Jose mine in Copica. You tell us the name of it, Seth. Where are you exactly, my friend?
Oh, everyone's been having trouble with that, Tom. It's like the most mispronounced thing of this story. But yes,
Copiapó
is a town about an hour drive from the mine here. I mean, this is the middle of seemingly nowhere. It's the center of, or in the Atacama Desert of Chile here, one of the driest places on Earth. And as you mentioned, this desolate strip of land is now home to not only families keeping vigil and the miners and the workers, but more than 1,000 journalists from all over the world who've descended to cover this absolutely fascinating story.
Here's the crowd at the San Jose mine this morning singing as the rescue operations got underway. You may have heard it, Seth. So there you are, Seth, as CBS News correspondent. What's the latest number as we speak at this moment? How many are up?
We're looking at number 16 on the way up. So about 12 hours into this and a little bit more than halfway through, the mining minister tweeted a couple of hours ago, that they were moving ahead of schedule. They were planning to extract one miner every hour, and things have worked like clockwork since things started here.
Here's the crowd when the very first one, Florencio Avalos, came out, the first of 33 miners surfacing after 69 days underground. Seth, what does this mean? It means everything to these miners and their families. What does it mean to Chile that they're coming up successfully so far at this point?
It means a lot to Chile, and that is part of the reason this has been so carefully choreographed. New president Sebastian Piñera, who has taken this very seriously. I mean, mining, you got to think, is the lifeblood, something like 40% or so of the income to the state. And mining is a lifeblood here. It's essential, and that's one of the reasons that Piñera put his minister of mining in charge of this and has taken very personal, paid very careful attention to this throughout the rescue operation. This is a country, as you remember, just over 6 months ago, endured a terrible earthquake. And this is a chance for Chile to be known not for tragedy, but for triumph.
This little capsule is coming up and going down again and again and again. What are the risks of it snagging somewhere along that very long descent and ascent? I mean, what are people saying about getting everybody out? Is it still a question? Are there still risks?
Of course, there are always risks. They're clear to say this is not over yet, but there is a level of confidence and excitement in the air now here. I'm in the middle of Camp Hope, where the families have been keeping vigil just in the shadow of this mine. In some cases, one woman came here just after the collapse, before they had even found that they were indeed alive and trapped. She slept in a chair for a while. So this means so much. At this point, you know, family members say they don't care if their family member comes out first or last. They just want them to come out, and I think they're buoyed by the success and speed with which the rescue operation is underway.
Here's the Chilean president, Sebastian Piñera, talking about these 69 days, what they've meant for the miners and the nation.
I'm sure that the miners will not be the same people that they were before this accident. And the Chilean people will not be the same people. We have learned from adversity. We have learned from this accident.
We certainly hope the mining company has learned from the accident. What about the miners? It's early days. No doubt it'll take them a while to unfold and for everybody to see what's happened here. But how do they look? What do we know about how they're coming up from this long ordeal?
Well, from a layman's perspective, watching it unfold on television, like so much of the world, it's estimated that close to a billion people around the world tuned in at one point to watch the details of this incredible rescue underway. And I was in the middle of the Camp Hope when the first miner was pulled out, as we mentioned earlier. And one of the things the family members were telling me was, my gosh, I can't believe how healthy these guys look. When they took that first step, I think there was a sense of disbelief. I think we had been prepared for these men who had, in most cases, lost something like 22 pounds on average in those first couple of weeks as they were rationing tiny spoonfuls of tuna and the little rations that they had in this small vestibule where they were trapped. Just an incredible story of survival.
And now they're coming up one by one. When do they hope the last will be up, Seth?
Well, Chile's time is now about an hour before New York, and the rescue operation started midnight local time last night. So I think they anticipated going well into the night tonight. They were anticipating trying to extract one miner every hour, 33 miners. So, you know, on target, you would think this should be roughly a 33-hour process, more than a day.
Everybody will certainly hope for that, and sooner the better. Seth Dhawan with CBS News at the Copiapó Mines, San Jose Mines in Copiapó, Chile. Seth, thank you very much for being with us there.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
Listeners, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.